From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment, the home edition. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It may seem like it's a long distance from the Brooklyn Bridge to Muhammad Ali, but not as long as you might think, especially for my guest, documentary director Ken Burns, who's done both those documentaries in addition to a whole bunch of other films. Muhammad Ali's his newest four-part series for PBS. Ken, thank you so much for doing this. It's good to talk to you here.
It's my pleasure, Elvis. Great to be with you.
One of the things, again, as I was watching Muhammad Ali's, I found myself thinking that it could be a kind of a de facto sequel to your film Unforgivable Blackness, The Rise and Fall of Jack Johnson, about 15 years ago.
Yeah, that came out in 2005. And, you know, there's a scene towards the end of that in which we learn that his life, Jack Johnson's life, was inspirational to Muhammad Ali. And then in our third episode of Ali, we hear it from the reverse angle. But this film on Ali is co-directed by my daughter, Sarah Burns, and her husband, David McMahon. And we also collaborated on the Central Park Five and Jackie Robinson in this. And there's something really interesting. Jack Johnson tried to achieve that level of freedom that Muhammad Ali achieved, and both men did it. Jack Johnson just did it for himself. Muhammad Ali did it for everyone. And so in a way, this is more in line with the Jackie Robinson story, because Jackie Robinson redefined Black manhood and Black masculinity in his generation, and then Muhammad Ali took it the next stop. Both men were willing to pay the price of freedom, exhibit the kind of courage both inside the ring or on the diamond that both had to do, as well as experience a kind of courage or exhibit a kind of courage outside the ring, outside the diamond. And so I think that there's kind of more parallels to Jackie Robinson than there are to Jack Johnson, even though the styles are very similar. And the government goes after both men with a vengeance because they are unable to defeat him in the ring.
Well, I'll tell you why I made that connection. It's because Jack Johnson and Ali were basically the first two men of color, African-Americans, who lived their lives in public the same way they lived them kind of in private. They were basically openly Black. Jackie Robinson was a bit more politic about it because he understood, he saw the big picture, and he came up through a team sport. And whereas I just feel like there's a kind of a proclamation of militancy that really unites, in a proto way, Jack Johnson to Muhammad Ali.
Yeah, very, very much so. Of course, you know, Jackie's famous for us pigeonholing him into the 3 years that he was asked to turn the other cheek, 1 year with the farm team, the Montreal Royals, and the next two in the major leagues, 47 and 48. When that was over, he suddenly was free to be more activist, and all of a sudden he was uppity. So there is some similarities, but I know exactly what you mean. Both Ali and Jack Johnson are defiantly their themselves. And the difference, I think, that's most important is Ali dies the most beloved person on his planet. Jack Johnson does not. And a lot of that had to do with what the motivations were for that kind of freedom. Ali seemed to come from some place of love as well as courage and freedom. Jack Johnson just wanted to be himself and resolutely himself. And it was perfectly all right. Sleep with whom he wanted to sleep with, marry whom he wanted to sleep with, and let the chips fall where they may. And Muhammad Ali, on the other hand, when he refuses induction into the United States Army, he's speaking for a people across the world. There's oppressed people. What so worried Jack Johnson among not just white, but middle-class Blacks was that he meant he stood only for himself. Ali stood for himself, but he was willing to bring everyone else along.
There's a piece of video you guys use, or I should say a film clip, used to start the second episode where Malcolm X is talking and he's being interviewed. And of course, there's that whole thing. You can see his jaw tense a little bit every time Ali's referred to as Cassius rather than Ali, but that's imminent still. But there's a great line that Malcolm X has when he's asked about Muhammad Ali turning to Islam, and he says, he's more capable of speaking for himself than every man in this country, which is such a weighted sentence because he both does that, but in a lot of ways, he doesn't do that. I mean, to me, that feels like the perfect encapsulation of what the series is.
Yeah, I think that that's exactly right. I mean, it's working on lots of different levels. We obviously want to understand the boxing. We obviously want to understand the arc of his entire life from birth and childhood in Jim Crow segregated Louisville to his death not that long ago from Parkinson's. But we also wanted to understand this as a story, as I've been saying, about freedom and how much it takes to achieve that. It's interesting that Malcolm X, his great friend and mentor, continues to call him Cassius Clay for a long time after Muhammad Ali or Cassius Clay has been rewarded for cutting Malcolm X off by being given this new name by Elijah Muhammad. And when he's actually referring to Cassius Clay in that interview, he has not yet been given that name. But later on, to me, it's very stunning that he uses Cassius again in a way that is not disrespectful. I think it's more disrespectful to the organization, the what I think Malcolm X correctly believes is a rather corrupt organization. And as his own view of Islam has expanded and has become more recognizable with mainstream Islam, he's hoping to bring his young protege along. He, of course, is torn between two masters and ends up remaining, though his own faith from the very beginning resembles more what Malcolm X is in the process of embracing. He's not going to live long enough to live it out. He's going to be murdered by the Nation of Islam. But it makes for a very dynamic and complicated story that is still fraught with this theme of freedom in the midst of questions of faith and religion, and in this particular case, Islam.
It's so fascinating because, again, that to me felt like such a crystallizing moment. And because it speaks to, at that point in Ali's history, his present and his future. I'm sure when you came upon that, you thought, this is key thematically to what we're doing here.
You know, we don't think that way when you're making a film. Nothing is key thematically. It just is fitting in and working. There's a kind of an emotional context. I don't mean sentimental or nostalgic, but there's a kind of a emotional archaeology involved in our searching and our sort of assembly of things. This is not additive. It's all subtractive process. To me, something much more telling or central is in the moment after the Supreme Court has liberated him from his 5-year prison sentence, finally, on a technicality, but it's an important one. He's been denied due process. And a reporter sticks a microphone in his face. And it's at that moment where everyone's vision of Ali at this time is to dance and recite poetry and to be smug and to be self-satisfied at this victory. And the reporter says, "What do you think about the system now?" And he says, "Well, I don't know who's going to be assassinated tonight. I don't know who's going to be enslaved, who's going to be denied justice or equality." And what that means is he's ranging back across 350 years of the mistreatment of African Americans on this continent since 1619, right past Emmett Till, the boy not too different in age from his, who was brutally tortured and murdered and whose mother had the courage to have an open casket. Jet magazine took pictures, and every black person in this country saw those pictures at that time, as did millions of others, and helped energize the civil rights movement in a way, but also leave kids like Muhammad Ali with a great deal of confusion and a great deal of fear. And he also seems to, in that moment, be speaking ahead, thinking about Rodney King and Trayvon Martin and 11-year-old Tamir Rice and Breonna Taylor from his own hometown of Louisville, Kentucky, and George Floyd, all names, along with, I'm sorry to say, thousands of other names that are too numerous for us to list, who he does not know yet, but who have been populating the cemeteries, the ditches, the rivers, the tree limbs of the United States for now 402 years. To me, the central telling quote of that, this person who at that point is supposed to be voluble and funny and defiant and egotistical and bombastic, is in fact reflective of his concern that he bring along and represent everyone who's ever felt the boot of the oppressor.
It's the truth. We're talking to Ken Burns, whose new project for PBS is the 4-part Muhammad Ali documentary series. To me, that's what I was saying at the outset, that he's a black person who leads his life in the same way publicly as he does privately, which is to say people of color, because it was a black press who put those pictures of Emmett Till out and forced the mainstream press's hand on that. And it was certainly something that black people talked about. And by being that person, the same person he would be in private that he is in public, and talking about the kinds of trepidations and anxieties people of color have, that to me is what connects him, but in a much more expansive way than Jack Johnson, who was basically fighting for his own freedom because that's all he could see.
Yeah, Jack Johnson couldn't see beyond that. He just wanted what he wanted. He wanted to sleep with whom he wanted to. He wanted to drink what he wanted to drink. He wanted to drive the fastest cars. And there's lots of outward similarities, but it really ends there because Muhammad Ali seems to be from a very early age when he's Cassius Clay on a kind of mission. He says, I know I'm here for a purpose when he's talking about abandoning boxing, as if his purpose isn't boxing. It's actually something more. And I don't think Jack Johnson, in my, you know, many, many years of study of him, had anything more than just doing what he wanted to do.
Basically, in subtle ways, reminding people, as he did in the cases of Sonny Liston and Joe Frazier, that they were darker than he. And there's a certain kind of association that goes along with that.
Well, I think this is the thing. People said, oh, my God, why Muhammad Ali? Aren't there so many documentaries? And there are. And in fact, Elvis, as you know, as well as I do, some of the best documentaries made, a couple of them, have been on Muhammad Ali. But we were hoping that we would have the opportunity to dig as deep as we were able to dig amidst all of this stuff, and not just the architecture, if you will, of just the fights, or resorting to the Nation of Islam as a one thing and not seeing this as a continuum of an evolving spiritual life of this person whose faith, you know, when he chooses not to go into the army, this is a faith decision. But because he's a black man in the United States, it's seen as a political gesture, a kind of middle finger to the United States. So, of course, the book is thrown at him. And he's willing, as he says, to face machine gun fire. So we were interested in a nuanced story that would hit all of the marks, but also deal with the undertow of his life and the undertow of America that's going on at the same time. This is a man who intersects with everything, you know, the role of sports in society, the role of the black athlete, notions of black masculinity and black manhood, what the civil rights movement is about, not as a one thing, but as a many dimensional changing thing about faith, about religion, about Islam, about politics, about war, about sex. These are all the things we're talking about now. So he becomes this incredibly useful figure for us now as we wrestle with many of the same things. Towards the very end of the film, as Howard Bryant, the great writer, is giving a kind of valedictory statement about Ali, we cut away to a demonstration on the Brooklyn Bridge. It's a young black woman wearing a simple black t-shirt with the letters Muhammad Ali on it in white. And all she needs to go to this demonstration, it's people are wearing masks, so you know it's now. All she needs to represent the freedom, the courage, and the love that he represented was to bring his name along. And that tells you a little bit about his enduring legacy. And it sort of even transcends the potentially nostalgic view that he died the most beloved person on the planet. He did. And that's a cold, hard fact. And billions with a B loved him and admired him for the way he represented them in their struggles, the way he understood or seemed to understand their struggles, whether it was black people in the United States or it was people in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, Saharan Africa, the Middle East, and Asia. And then all the other people elsewhere who admired him for these very same reasons.
We're going to take a break and talk more with our friend Ken Burns, whose newest documentary for our miniseries is Muhammad Ali. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
We're being way too serious to that old friend Ken Burns, whose new docuseries, Muhammad Ali, is on PBS. I guess one of the things I want to talk about, too, and you were getting at it here, and we get it in the documentary as well, is it's also about the generational shift in the press. And that press conference where he's talking about converting to Islam, this group of people who are probably the kind of people you grew up reading, is this man, again, revealing himself, which is not something that black celebrities did. You were one person in front of the world, somebody else when that was gone. But to be that self-reflective in real time And you were talking about that, when he responds to the Supreme Court decision coming down. He's buying an orange at a corner store in Chicago. So he's constantly in touch with people. I mean, there are volumes that this series gives you a chance to touch upon.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you saw them. And after having tried to break your connections to Jack Johnson, you know, let me try to reforge them in a way, in that his trials are so significant. Joe Louis is the only black man, light-skinned Joe Louis, who's permitted to become the heavyweight champion because he's agreed in advance he will not be photographed with white women. He will not, you know, gloat over his victories. So this is the price Joe Louis has to pay for his decades plus time at the top. And this is all the anti-Jack Johnson. He just had to promise he wouldn't be anything like Jack Johnson. Dark-skinned, loving white women, sleeping with white women, marrying white women, gloating over his victories over every great white hope that came up. So Muhammad Ali comes in and he's suddenly doing all the, quote, mistakes that Joe Louis didn't do and that the world felt Jack Johnson had. So here he is, and there is this old guard that is just apoplectic at the idea that an athlete would behave this way, let alone a black athlete. He was not behaving himself, right? But the younger ones are kind of fascinated. The Robert Lipsites, the Dave Kindreds, the Jerry Eisenbergs, eventually a Howard Cosell, who are going to find a kind of symbiotic relationship with him. And they're watching him and they love him. And then that quiet press conference after he's beat Sonny Liston, he's not bombastic anymore. He's suddenly saying, I don't have to be what you want me to be. I can be what I want to be. And as Lipsyte said, it's an athletic declaration of independence nobody had ever heard before. Even in Jackie's powerful example, he was fitting the mold of a Christ-like figure. This is somebody who was about to declare, not in that moment, but shortly, that he is a member of the Nation of Islam, a separatist religious cult that actually bears very little resemblance to mainstream Islam and has already been labeled in fear-mongering by other media outlets as a hate group. And so he's doing that. And just a little while later, he's got a new name. So he's strike one for the bombast and the bragging, strike two for joining the Nation of Islam and getting a new name, and then strike three, you are out by refusing induction into the draft. But what's interesting is there are people who are witnessing this. Black people are witnessing this. And when he says, I'm beautiful and I'm black, they are hearing that as a message of affirmation. Nobody had said that quite that way before. It now sounds, of course, but then this was something really new. And people heard it and reverberated because of his conversion around the world. And that had meaning. And then finally, even though it's not a political decision to refuse the draft, it becomes a political manifestation because in order to survive, it's the peak of his professional career and he loses 3.5 years. He goes on the lecture circuit and becomes a darling of the left-wing anti-war movement. And he does so with such joie de vivre, such humor, such great poise and kind of confidence that you suddenly realize here is the hero for an entirely new different generation. And while a good deal of America is reviling him, it's going to be hard to hold that for very long because A, he's right on Vietnam. B, he stood up and held his ground. He was representing his convictions. And after a while, people realized, you know, what he gave up, what he sacrificed, and how resolute he was in those beliefs. And it begins to melt away a good deal of that animosity. Now, I'm sure there are still some unreconstructed brethren who might feel otherwise, but by the time he dies, he's that big a deal. As David Remnick says in the beginning, he's revered almost like the Buddha, like a religious figure.
It's true. My guest who has some brethren who basically still need to do some converting is Ken Burns. We're talking about his docuseries, his newest, Muhammad Ali, which is on PBS. And it's funny because I can't help but see connector threads. And before this, you just did the Hemingway series, which is about somebody who's also creating a mythology around himself. Then the growth of mass media in the 20th century. For me, there's a kind of a connection between Ali, Hemingway, and country music. They're all about the rise of media in this way, and the rise of technology in media, and new generation of media coming along and grabbing holds. In the case of Hemingway, him being a part of that media who was crafting that message, they en masse, they seem to be about the burgeoning of American media in the 20th century.
That is so, so smart, Elvis. That's exactly right. Not that we do this consciously, but you know, all of a sudden, you know, you're waking up in the middle of 4 or 5 years into Ali and going, oh my God, he had 4 wives. So did Ernest Hemingway. It doesn't end so well for Hemingway. You know, he dies at 60, 61 with a self-inflicted shotgun blast.
But fears about the same thing, about losing his capacities.
But also losing his capacities. Muhammad Ali moves into the loss of capacities and actually speaks in a much broader way when he can no longer speak. It's so interesting. And you know, Hemingway's tragic. It's self-involved and he gets lost in his mythology. Muhammad Ali doesn't. He's always set up a separate, as you suggested earlier, he's this way at home. He set up a separate independent witness that is its own bullshit meter for him. That to me is so great. And while he is self-deluding at times, it isn't the wholesale buying in to it that Hemingway did. And even then, as we learn about Hemingway's gender fluidity, you begin to realize that perhaps that masculine mask, that toxic hyper-masculine persona, which was true, he was a brawler, he was a deep-sea fisherman, he was a bullfight aficionado, he was a big game hunter and a deep-sea fisherman. It was also masking curiosities that permeated into his writing about how women felt and how women believed. So he was at war with himself in a way that I don't think Ali was. Now, the interesting thing is that the next film that I've finished that will be out in the spring is on Benjamin Franklin, who's born the same day as Muhammad Ali, January 17th. And he is arguably the most interesting person of the 18th century, you know, who's a polymath doing lots of things, who's funny, who is a great out there in the world public speaker. He's the greatest diplomat in American history. You know, he starts off owning when he has some money, he has enslaved some people in his household, but he becomes an abolitionist at the end and proposes abolition of slavery to the first Congress. A lot of good that did him or us or them. But there's a kind of, you know, you don't plan it this way. You don't think, oh, let's do 3 people in a row who are awfully similar. And yet it's a jigsaw puzzle. You know, I think of it more as a weaving, you know, the warp and woof of American history sort of intersects with everybody. You know, it was King who said, you know, all people are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality. That might as well be a description of the sum total of Brooklyn Bridge, as you kindly pointed out, when this guy who looked 12 years old was trying to sell people the Brooklyn Bridge 1,000 years ago, and Muhammad Ali. There is a inescapable network of mutuality, and as he went on, tied in a single garment of destiny.
Well, it's something else I think we can find in this work, too, that often is not, when it's not about a big social context like the Vietnam War or the Roosevelts or the national parks or prohibition, you often are focused on people with a gift. For the first 5 years of his career, Ali's reflexes were so good that he didn't need to have technique. And the film pays attention to the fact that he was not just a great athlete, an astonishing athlete who could do so much stuff in real time. And I feel like I want to talk to you about this, Ken, because I feel that subtextually that's what this is about, that those appetites you were talking about partially came from the fact that his career was derailed at its peak by his own decision, by the way. But a lot of that just seemed to be him almost living out this adolescent life and post-adolescence, because he didn't get the chance to fail in the way the athletes would have had he had a chance to have those years when he didn't get a chance to box.
Let's presume the what if. I think he would have just kept on winning and winning and winning and maybe gotten lazy and lost in a way. I mean, he came back. He lost that time. He was out of shape. He won the first 2 fights against Jerry Corey and then Bonavina, and then lost to Frazier, won several fights and then lost again to Norton, then came back and beat Norton, and then came back and beat Frazier, and then was able to recapture the heavyweight championship for the second time, 10 years after he got it the first time, in 10 and a half years in the Rumble in the Jungle against George Foreman, one of the great moments. But you're right. This is a guy who is completely untrained and untutored. His abilities are so natural and innate. He's not going to be bent by anybody else. Angelo Dundee is not going to break these habits. He's going to be as Michael Bent, our secret weapon, a former heavyweight champion that we embed.
He's terrific in this, by the way. He's great in this.
We embed him in every significant fight, and he helps, talk about the strategy and tactics, yes, but also the psychologies and the wills and the dramas that's going on between and within the rounds. And so you get a sense of participation in a way that I think is extraordinarily helpful. And he's shaking his hand sometimes. He's referring to his fight with Big Cat Williams, you know, just before the draft stuff blew up, as being Picasso, as being Baryshnikov, as being Miles Davis, this masterpiece of dominance. And you know, he had the same fight with Zora Foley, which same sort of thing. But by that time, he'd been reclassified 1A, and all of a sudden, we're plowing into this political-religious dynamic. But he's something else. You know, he's born out of the womb, Michael Benn said, doing these things that you're not supposed to do in boxing. It'll catch up to him, and he's going to have to adapt. And he unfortunately adapts in ways that are incredibly detrimental to his health. But he's going to be able to do what nobody else has ever done, his climb back up to the top, not just twice, but a third time.
By the way, you're talking to Ken Burns, his new docuseries, Muhammad Ali, in four parts, is on PBS. What happens in this, that for me, that I always got, is not only is the astonishing ability, but joy in this. I mean, he took so much pleasure in it. And that's a rarity, to see somebody who's that immersed in craft and instinct and power and ability and intelligence, but also the pleasure he got from it. All these things you're talking about feel almost vaguely sexual.
You know, oh, it is. Look, he's the most beautiful person you've seen. I mean, I think if Michelangelo was going to be commissioned to sculpt David right now, he goes, well, I don't think so. Maybe I'll do Muhammad Ali. He is gorgeous. And you can say that. He's not only the athlete of the century, and I think we tend to, because it's so much easier to do Elvis, his talk about the easier things, the freedom in context of race and politics, the courage in the context of race and politics and the sport of boxing. But there's also this other dimension that I've been trying to say, that the FCC allows me to say, allows you to say, but nobody wants to talk about it, which is love. You know, he loves this game. He loves himself. He loves the life he's living. He seems to love everyone around him. He wants to reach out and give everyone something. He is generous to a fault, the cliche goes, giving away tens of thousands of dollars a day to people with hard luck stories, or, you know, in a wheelchair, or, you know, winos that just are cold and he gives them his cashmere coat, or the Rolex watch he just bought off his wrist. You know, he said, and it's on his gravestone, you know, service to others is the rent you pay for your room in heaven. I like the picture when the Beatles show up in part of the British invasion in 64, when he's training for the Liston fight at the second floor, Fifth Street CD gym in Miami. And there's a fake publicity thing, talk about your media stuff, of him punching George, who's falling into Ringo, who's falling into John, who's falling into Paul. But all five of these men understood a fundamental principle of the mechanics of the universe, and that is that love multiplies. John Lennon said, all you need is love. He's gone. Paul McCartney's still around, maybe said it the best. And in the end, the love you take is equal to the love you make. Muhammad Ali practiced that in a different place. It wasn't in the music business, but he did it in a way that so transcended his skills, so transcended the circumstances, both positive and negative, of his life, that he becomes a kind of avatar or apostle of all of these things. Freedom, yes. A courage, yes. But also love. And that, I think, is by the end of the last episode, something that is a palpable thing. It has a materiality to it, just as people tell us that the soul has a kind of minute but definitive materiality. And I think that, to me, at the end, is what I was so fascinated by.
We could go on forever about this, but I'm going to close it before we find something else to disagree about. My guest is Ken Burns. His new film for PBS is the four-part Muhammad Ali series. Ken, I can't thank you enough for doing this. I wish you'd been here earlier. You got to come back, because I'm sure we can talk Ben Franklin, but you're welcome here whenever you'd like.
I'm happy to come back, Elvis. It's been so great to speak with you.
Our production staff includes Katie Gilchrist, John Meek, Paul Smith, and Desmond Taylor. The show is edited and produced by Rebecca Mooney. To better days, everybody. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.